This is Chick Flick Fix. I'm Julia Scott.
And I'm AJ Knox.
And we're joined this week by Anthony Johnston, who is a writer with games and text novels and graphic novels under his belt. I try to think, because like graphic is technically also writing. This only matters in my brain. His book, The Coldest City, became the movie Atomic Blonde in 2017. And I'm very excited about this. A sequel was announced several times, but most recently last year, and is supposedly going to be on Netflix soonish. And I don't know if you can tell us anything about that.
No, I can't. I can't tell you anything about it because I don't know anything about it. All I know is that everybody wants to do it, and we're waiting for somebody to actually, you know, sign all the necessary papers for it to start. Until that point, it's vaporware, you know.
But I think that's very cool. What we do here is we watch chick flicks and rom-coms and decide if they need fixing. Can we make them better or can we make them weird? This week, we're talking about Three Men and a Baby from 1987, which is directed by Leonard frickin' Nimoy.
That blew my mind when watching the opening credits. I was suddenly like, this is not going to be the movie I thought it was.
Wait, do you mean recently? Had you not seen this before?
I saw it maybe when I was a kid, but I haven't revisited this. So Anthony, one of the fun things about this podcast is it's either reintroducing me to movies I saw once when I was like 12, or it's totally introducing me to movies I've never seen. So I was reintroduced to this movie.
I actually realized that I've seen this, but I didn't remember much of it, and I realized that I was thinking of the movie Three Men and
Little Lady,
which I think I've seen more of, but possibly mostly in like spurts watching something else as well.
Well, and it's not as good. I mean, it's okay as sequels go, but it's not as good as this movie. So I'm more familiar with this movie than either of the hosts.
Yeah.
Because I've seen this movie quite a few times.
The sequel is actually... Because, like, this was supposed to be a pretty dark movie. Like, the original was... More adult-y. No. More. Like, there was more cursing. Paul Milner, the drug addict... He's not the kingpin. The drug dealer manager was supposed to have a much larger role. Also, Jack was a pilot, which I'm like, ooh, that's bad drugs. But, like, the sequel is way more family-friendly. This is... Yes, there are some high stakes in this movie. But this movie, it's written by James Orr and Jim Cruikshank, based on a French film called Trois Hommes et un Couffin, which is Three Men and a Cradle, not a baby, but, you know, the baby is implied, which was written and directed by Colleen Serrault. It stars Tom Selleck, Steve Guttenberg, Ted Danson, and a baby. The baby is, of course, played by twins, because they always are, Lisa and Michelle Blair. About a bajillion different actors were considered for the three different guys. I'm not even going to try listing them. It was originally set to be directed by Colleen Serrault, who wrote and directed the original.
Oh, I didn't know that.
But Serrault dropped out right after they'd like finished the casting, and I'm not sure if that's related or is a coincidence, but it's funny in my head.
But what a crazy thing to do then. So, like, you've got your director lined up. You then get... big stars. You know, people don't think really of people like Ted Danson and Tom Selleck now as big movie stars. But remember, at the time, they were, you know, they weren't big movie stars, but they were huge TV stars. And then you hire Leonard Nimoy.
Yeah.
They had like 5,000 hopeful extras show up for the party scene in the beginning, because people thought that you'd get to like see Tom Selleck at the audition. People were so excited about it. And they cast like 100 people who are in that amazing apartment. But like, that's the level that Tom Selleck was at the time. This was the highest grossing movie in the US of the year, 1987.
Yep. Oh, but yeah, imagine going from that to then hiring Leonard Nimoy, who I think before this, his only directing feature had been the Star Trek movies, I think, right?
But at the same time, like...
I thought it was three.
I've heard that Nimoy is, or was, just very good at what he did. And I could see also, you know,
no question.
He did a lot of photography. I love his Fat Lady series. But, like, I could see him just being one of those people where everyone in Hollywood is just like, he's nice, he's polite, he knows what he's doing. Mm-hmm. Also, it's going to be hilarious to bring him in on this.
Like Ron Howard. It's the sort of thing where you'd bring in Ron Howard today, isn't it?
Yeah.
You go, look, he's reliable, everybody likes him, he'll do the job, no messing around.
Yeah. And you're only going to be able to see his main character in front of you every time he talks. In both cases. Yeah. This movie has one of those pieces of like cinema trivia that shows up on pretty much every listicle of Did You Know? Because there's this myth about a brief shot of the ghost of a boy who either was killed or took his own life in the house where they shot the film.
Wait, behind the curtains?
Yeah.
I saw that and I was like, what the frig was that?
It's a cardboard cutout of Ted Danson that you see at the very end of the film from like a commercial that he did. Oh. And it's like briefly behind a curtain. And I think the thing is also the way he's set up. You don't see his arms in his like magician pose.
See it's like in between the curtains. It's like a head and a torso. Yeah, so it's really
one of those
creepy.
Like huge creepy trivia things. Also, they shot on a soundstage. So
yeah, it wasn't shot in a house. It's like this myth about the house where they shot, but there was no house.
Yeah, but I could definitely see it being one of those things that is very satisfying to like share on the playground.
Oh, completely. Yeah, absolutely. Although I must admit, I don't remember it. I think that was a VHS. That myth probably started when the VHS became available, because the shot is so fleeting. I mean, I was 15 when this movie came out, and I went to see it at the theater twice. In fact, and alone both times, I should also point out, because I was a 15-year-old boy. I was mostly into heavy metal and goth music and progressive rock at that point. None of my friends wanted to go and see this movie, but I did. And I enjoyed it so much, I went back to see it again.
This is my favorite origin story I have ever heard.
Yeah.
But I don't remember anybody else talking about that. I don't remember that hearing that myth at all until years later, after it would have been available on VHS, and I certainly saw it again then on VHS. So I think it was one of those things that probably came about when people could pause it, you know?
Yeah, I think this is right up there with like the dangling feet. Yeah, in The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
Okay, Anthony, I was going to ask why you picked this as the movie, but clearly you just hold a deep love for...
I'm not a huge rom-com watcher. I have nothing against them. You know, I like a good rom-com now and again, but it's not a genre that I am deeply into. But I went to saw this, I think, just because it got so much hype because of the stars. You know, there was such, like I say, these guys were all such big stars at the time when it was released. So I thought, oh, yeah, okay, I'll go and see that. Like I say, none of my friends wanted to see it with me, so I went on my own. And I just loved it. It made me laugh. It made me cry at the end. I remember being in tears at the final scene. It really affected me. And so, yeah, I went back and saw it again, loved it again. And it's just, I've seen it a few times over the years since. It's always had that kind of special place in my heart. And I have, watching it this time again, and this was the first time that I'd watched it in 10 years or more this time around. And watching it again this time, obviously I can see the flaws, especially those parts of it which are of its time, shall we say.
Yeah.
Much more easily now, you know, from a modern perspective. But it is still a very, very funny film. There's no getting around
that. Oh, it is. I laughed out loud, and I don't usually laugh out loud.
Right. And it's also very emotionally effective, you know, very manipulative in the good way that movies are.
Mm-hmm.
I think Nimoy does a really good job of guiding the audience's feelings and emotions about it. And I thought about where I was when I was 15. I have a younger sister who is 10 years younger than me. Mm. So I was old enough to watch her grow up as a baby, you know, as I was sort of old enough that I was aware of her as an infant. And I don't know for sure if that is one of the reasons why I took to this movie, but I remember even when I was 15, it was ridiculous because these guys at the time obviously were 30 years older than I was then. But I could genuinely relate to all this hassle about dealing with a kid in the house that you suddenly did not expect, you know?
AJ, so, you had some warning at least for...
Yeah, well, I will say, Anthony, I think that I found this film so funny, particularly because I have a 10-week-old at home.
Right, exactly.
And it's our first child. And so there's all these jokes that clearly come from experience. The the idea that the baby's just fallen asleep and then the sirens all go off outside and they rush to like shut all the windows and block the sound and then and everybody freezes and waits and holds their breath. And then the moment where the baby looks like she's staying awake, it's like, oh, damn it. You know, and
it's, they're moments of observational comedy. And we think of that phrase as referring to stand-up. You know, that's how we refer to certain stand-up comics, isn't it? But you can do that in fiction as well. And I think that's one of the reasons why this movie holds up, is because those moments are universal. It doesn't matter where you are, whether it's 500 years ago, now, or 500 years in the future. Parents will always want babies to sleep, and babies will always want to wake up.
And it strikes me that it is observational physical comedy, because nobody, I think they maybe at one point say something about don't wake up the baby, but it is only like implied through their actions. Like she can't wake up. And that is also like a skill to make something completely recognizable just through.
Well, and ironically, we watched this with our baby sleeping in the little swing in the living room, with the TV on very low, her sound machine on, and the subtitles on, so we could like just kind of barely. And I mean, it was like watching the movie while living the movie
Method watching.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's funny though, and I mean, we'll get into this, but talking about like the flaws that are of its time, I still feel like, not just for its time, but for like the genre, the tone, and the stars, this is surprisingly, I mean, A, progressive in some way, but also just like doesn't feel modern cringy. You're not just like, ooh, there are parts of it that feel very 80s and like the way the story is told. But I think I maybe would have expected more crudeness. Like you get you get a lot of like revolving lady doors, but I mean that's each to their own, you know.
And I was expecting at least like a small handful of gay panic jokes, but
of like here are these two men together. Yeah. They never even try.
But bad news, we just pressed play on Three Men and a Little Lady, and they get into that pretty quick. They get into in that one she's grown up and she's trying to go to school and she's like they're interviewing for a school and she's there with another kid. She's drawing a picture of her family, which includes three dads, and the kid's like, you're only allowed to have one dad, it's the law. And it's like
which is funny though.
But then immediately then it like cuts back to like the three of them, well, the four of them, because the mom's there too, like being interviewed by the school counselors. And they're like, oh, yeah, no, we don't have any other women come in the house. No, like it's just a totally like we're clean cut. And one of the interviewers is like, oh, so you're gay, like really enthusiastically. And they all immediately like, no. And I'm like, oh, okay. So
yeah, but it probably because the original was French, and the French are like, okay. AJ, what is this movie about?
Jack.
Angela. Boy, you look different. What happened?
I'm dressed.
That's it.
Three incredibly eligible men hoping to meet some incredibly perfect women.
So many women in so little time.
Now, at last, they're about to find that one girl who will sweep them off their feet.
That's a baby.
It's a baby.
Of course it's a baby.
It's your baby.
No, it's not my baby. It's Jack's baby.
The child doesn't look anything like me. I have more hair.
I want to see the way you three big guys handle this one.
Okay. So, Three Men and a Baby is, I would say, mistitled, because the third man doesn't show up for half the movie.
And is a giant man baby.
And is a giant. So it should be Two Men, a Baby, and a Man Baby. But no. Oh, so Three Men and a Baby is about these three swinging bachelors who all live in a really swanky New York apartment.
I mean, it's like the penthouse, full floor. It's
and I can
amazing.
I can only imagine they live there because Tom Selleck is, drumroll please, he's an architect. It's either an architect or a journalist, right? So,
oh, I think they make that quite explicit. Yeah. That this is his building. And so, yes, he literally designed the penthouse.
Yeah, and it's an awesome...
There's, like, a hothouse halfway through it.
Like, the kitchen is in a greenhouse, which is in the middle. I don't know. I love it. I want to live there.
It's on the roof, isn't it? So it's exposed to the to the sky.
It's beautiful. I want to live there.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so we're introduced to them through a opening credits kind of... And this is the film's signature technique of montages, is to speed them up to, like, 1.5 speed. So it's a little uncanny, but we're introduced to, like, the comings and goings of these three swinging bachelors as all these women are kind of...
And it's funny, you know, because the drawing of the cartoon mural as these women are coming through makes it feel as though it's, like, a stylized animated intro, even though it is a literal intro, which I really, really like.
Over a jaunty 80s pop song soundtrack as well.
Yeah.
But what's funny is there's... I don't think there are any, like, songs... Or there's one or two songs, and then there's mostly, like, score. And all of it, or I think almost all of it, unless it's, like, the party music, which is over the party, is almost only in the montages. Like, there isn't much music throughout the movie, which feels
not 80s. But it does open with that Bad Bad Boys number, which is very, very 80s.
Yeah.
Bad boys.
And so we're introduced to these three bad boys who are, you know, ladies men. And one of them, Steve Guttenberg, is painting a mural in the, what would you call that, a foyer? In the foyer. And you're slowly kind of getting the sense of this mural coming together over time as all these women kind of come and go. Then we are at a swinging bachelor party, which this party is insane. Like, this is a... Huge.
I'm pretty sure that that's a fire hazard. I don't see how they can have that.
I mean, the
many
best parties
the
are always fire hazards.
Exactly.
And I swear, you know, this podcast is going to be colored by the pandemic for a long time, because I turned to my couchmate and went, "Do you remember parties?"
Yeah, I know.
Can you imagine being that close to so many people for so long?
Jenna immediately went, "Oh, this is not safe." what will be the title of my autobiography, Steve Guttenberg introduces the party as the lifestyles of the average and anxious.
Did you know that Gutenberg's autobiography is called the Gutenberg Bible?
Of course it is.
Very good, very good.
But I just love that lifestyles of the average and anxious. I identified with that so much. But yeah, we're going through the party. Ted Danson is an actor. Steve Guttenberg is a cartoonist who has created a cat who we hear the voice of later. And I will tell you, do not watch this movie with subtitles, because the cat puppet that he has created, the kind of iconic cartoon character that looks like Chester Cheetah, is supposed to be like a cool, hep cat. And... when he's doing his voice, it's already a little problematic, because it definitely feels like black voice. But in the subtitles, it says, "In jive."
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
So there's that.
Okay, okay.
So he's created a racist cat cartoon.
Yeah. I thought you were going to say in ebonics or something, which wouldn't be any better.
No, I mean, he's basically created a racist cat cartoon.
It's the cat from the Paula Abdul video.
Oh, it totally is. Although that cat just always reminds me of Chester Cheetah. I don't know why. I just think of Chester Cheetah as that cat.
And it's Tom Selleck's birthday and he's an architect.
Yes. And
Because they talk about, like, they've been together for 5 years, and for a few seconds, you're like, hey, but they have an open relationship, and it's open on both sides, and everybody in the relationship knows it.
Mm-hmm.
Which, again,
and
like,
progressive.
That's, yeah, like, weirdly progressive, in the same way that I love that at several points throughout this movie, they try to get women to take care of the baby because chromosomes, like, and the women are like, nope. Bye.
I've got my own life, dudes.
Yeah, and also, like, I don't know what to do with this baby just because
I'm a woman.
Yeah. And it's again very progressive in a weird way, and I know we shouldn't be, like, you know, adulation over men who do stuff, but that's just, it's a,
for 1987, I mean, you've got to take it in context. I think that moment as well with the open relationship it feels, watching it back now, it almost feels like it's deliberately setting you up to kind of pull the rug out from under you, because it is almost, it's shot in a way that you could very easily imagine
He's just a slime
ball. His character, right, yeah, yeah, telling women, oh, yes, no, we're in an open relationship, when, of course, that's not actually the case. Mm. And then, you know, very quickly is revealed to be the case. And you're like, oh, I wasn't expecting that at all.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether that was deliberate or if it's just having, you know, watching it again from a modern perspective.
Well, and when he is confronted with the other partner in the open relationship, he's like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
You know, he's like, but, and she's like, no, this is the terms we agreed to. These are the terms we agreed to.
Right. And but then he doesn't, and he accepts it. He doesn't like it, but he's like, okay, all right, fine. Yeah,
and it's like,
but
kind of like equal parts vague jealousy and equal parts, no, but I need your services.
Yeah. All right. So jumping back to the party. Yeah. We're introduced to Tom Selleck's partner, and they're in an open relationship. And Ted Danson's director, Ted Danson is an actor who's kind of trying to go a little bit more professional. He does some commercials, he does some theater, and he's trying to up his career. And a director who he's worked with is there, says, hey, I'm going to be out of town. I'm getting a package delivered. Can I get the package delivered to you so you can take care of it for me? And he's like, sure, no problem.
And right away, you're just like, no, 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 no.
Yeah.
It's at that point as well that you realize that Jack clearly has never watched an episode of Miami Vice, because this director looks straight out of Miami Vice.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Yeah. He came from a lineup to be in this party.
Yeah.
And I was also watching this. I was like, parties in the 80s were so smoky, always.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But very evenly smoky.
Yeah, very evenly smoky. And then for whatever reason, this whole party reminded me of this is going to be like the weirdest connection, but for whatever reason reminded me of the Foot Clan hideout in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, where all like the teenagers are hanging out, like smoking cigarettes and drinking beer and skateboarding. There was something about like the light quality.
Well, also just like you can't see much of the apartment. You really only see like these pillars sort of.
Yeah.
So it's just like, is this a basement?
And yeah. TMNT is a very dingy movie. You know,
it is a very dingy movie.
Yeah, considering the target audience at the time, it was shot as if it was some kind of low-budget Mad Max-esque.
Yeah.
Wait, do you guys want them to send a cleaning crew into the sewers?
That's a good point. That's a very good point. And so at this point, too, you're also getting introduced to all the three men, right? And I was like, immediately, for whatever reason, I started recasting this as a contemporary film. I was like, who would these actors be today?
Mm-hmm.
And so Tom Selleck, I'm just going to go off on a little tangent. Tom Selleck, I think, is either Channing Tatum or Zac Efron, but like not twink Zac Efron, like baby daddy Zac
Efron.
Bearded
Tom.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Not John Hamm?
I feel like that's too old. I feel like I want to keep these guys around like 30.
Oh, okay. Tom Selleck was not 30 when this movie
was made. I know, that
is
true. That, yeah.
No way.
I think for today, it would feel weirder to have actors in their
40s. That's true, actually. Yeah. Actors generally, your characters are generally pitched younger these days, aren't they?
Yeah.
That's true.
And so then I was thinking Ted Danson's character, Damon Wayans Jr.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, okay.
And then I was thinking Steve Guttenberg. I was like, okay, he's like the sad sack. I was thinking this would be a little too young. Tom Holland. He could play like a fun, kind of neurotic.
Yeah. I will co-sign. I wish they had done more with his sad sackiness, because the thing of him just like becoming everyone's like shoulder to cry on and he sends them back. It's like, what is that stupid movie with where he's like everyone when they break up with him meets the love of their life?
Yeah. But the other options for the Steve Guttenberg character would be Adam Devine from Workaholics and Pitch Perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Or Paul Rudd, who I know would age.
I was going to say Paul Rudd, but he's way too old. Yeah.
He's way too old.
Except he's not.
He looks like he's 24.
Yeah, I know. How does he do it, man?
Anyway, but then I went down a rabbit hole, and Jenna was looking it up, and Jenna also was like, oh, Zac Efron for the
Tom Selleck
character. And then she looked it up. They're making a remake with Zac Efron.
What?
Oh, really?
Yes.
Wow. Okay.
So well you done. Guys just hit the zeitgeist.
I know. So there's something about it. Anyway. All right. We're still way early in this movie. Yes. He's getting a package. Flash forward. Tom Selleck is coming home and he opens the door, steps over a baby bassinet and goes in the house. Ted Danson is off shooting a commercial in Turkey or something, and he opens the door again, classic double take, there's a baby outside, and calls Steve Guttenberg in. He's like, all right, haha, very funny, what is going on? There's a note on the baby for Ted Danson saying, this is yours, deal with it, love, Sylvia, this is Mary.
And I love how both of them just, like, assume and accept that this is the package.
Yes. The package that is going to be delivered. Because
I feel like if you're dropping a baby off with someone, you would be like, there's going to be a baby coming.
Yes. Have you're getting a baby food tomorrow. Yeah. FedEx is going to drop off a baby. You have to sign for it. And yeah, so they take the baby in, and very quickly hijinks ensue. They realize, like, okay, what do we got?
How do you baby?
Well, they realize they have no idea how to deal with a baby. Yeah, they've never done so. They have no experience of it. They have no knowledge of it. I think that's the whole delivery of the quote unquote package thing is the one. Every movie, every piece of fiction has one big leap that it asks the audience to make. There's one big thing that you can get away with. And it can be some ridiculous coincidence or something completely unreal.
Yeah.
But as long as there's only one, the audience will go along with you because, like, oh, well, this is the point of the movie. Without this, there is no movie. So therefore, we'll go with you on that. As long as you don't have more than that, you're generally okay. And I feel that that is the leap of this movie, is accepting that they would just think it was entirely normal for a baby to be delivered without a chaperone of any kind and just left on their doorstep.
Yeah.
Of course, it's absurd. You think about it for even a moment, you're like, wait, that's insane.
Yeah.
But like I say, that's the leap.
What I think here is there's two things about what kind of makes the leap work is that I think they also immediately panic because the baby's crying almost right away.
Yes.
So, like, there is very little room left in your head when you...
It distracts you.
When you weren't expecting a baby, you don't know what to do with the baby. The baby is crying and you're just like, fix it, make, you know. But also because so very quickly after that, we get the heroine that AJ is about to tell us about.
Yeah.
Which, where you're like, whom do you think you're protecting right now? Why don't you call the police? But, you know, but that is the other thing where I'm like, which is my main problem, the leap that I am not accepting in this movie. Why are they protecting Sylvia? Because she abandoned a baby in a hallway. She didn't know that they were going to be there. She just abandoned it. No instructions, no food, no nothing. That is a criminal offense in a lot of jurisdictions, both within and outside the U.S. They don't call the police. They don't call Child Protective Services. They don't, you know, nothing. They're just like, because that is bad. That says that she, I mean, and I'm not saying like, oh, she's a bad person, a bad mother, but she needs help and she should not just be given that baby back. Regardless of everything else about, like, you know, custody agreements over different nations, because that can be very complicated. And for that matter, in the 80s, the mother usually got custody regardless of country. But that is just, like, accepted beyond, like, just like, oh, you're back. Here you go. And I'm like, this wasn't, like, a potted ficus that you watered for.
Yeah, when they get to the end, and as you say, they just kind of unquestioningly hand the baby, oh, well, here you go then. That is a moment where you're like, wait a second.
And so right away, I'm like, yes, all this chaos ensues so that, like, they don't want, I am assuming, like, police officer to come in to pick up the baby and sense that the heroine is around.
Well, that's, I mean, from a sort of, just from a kind of fiction making point of view, you have to distract the audience at moments like this, and that's what the chaos does. So
yeah, so it distracts them and us.
Them being panicked because the baby starts crying distracts the audience. Mm-hmm. Then the heroine arriving is another distraction and also sets up the conflict. So now you've moved past the leap and now you're into telling the audience this is actually going to be the big dilemma of the movie. Not
if you've already got them with the first leap.
Right, well, we have how do you take care of a baby? That's the comedy.
Yeah.
But you still have, even in a rom-com, you still have to have that conflict, that clash. And here's the clash. Oh, okay, this sort of dilemma of how do we keep the baby safe when we have drug dealers on the loose and all that sort of thing.
which is, again, ridiculous. pretty high stakes, really dark for what is, in some ways, a family movie. And I should say also, like, this is, you know, If it qualifies as a rom-com, it's way heavier on the com than the rom. But yeah. We do have, you know, ladies around, and it's like, it becomes much more of that in the sequel.
And also, it's a kind of, if there's any rom in this, it's between the men and the baby.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If there is any kind of, you know, love that needs to grow and, you know, for the men to realize, oh, okay, actually, this is what's important to me, it's between them and the baby.
And I would say also between the three of them, because before that, it feels like they have that sort of relationship where they're sort of, you know, at best kind of smilingly accepting of each other and usually probably annoyed with each other at different sort of levels. But with the baby, they also, you know, realize that they do care about each other. And also, again, there, like, that family is also what's important, not just the baby family.
Well, up until now, they've never been threatened. I mean, mm-hmm. That's the core of the relationship between the three men, is that they've had everything. You know, they're rich, they're famous, they have, as you say, a revolving door of women. They have no problems, basically.
Well, and... just to go back to the rom-com thing, I know we're totally jumping around the movie, but the rom-com thing. I mean, the movie even ends with a we gotta chase her down at the airport
through the airport, right?
Yeah,
you know, which is like classic.
But they're chasing
rom-com
the tiny lady is who they're chasing through the airport.
Yeah.
I was just going to say talking about the distractions. The point I wanted to make about that is that's the same thing they do at the end when she comes back. Or near the end, when the mother arrives back and they say, oh, okay, you can have the baby now. Mm-hmm. Again, they distract you because you have that moment where you've got her and Ted Danson's character, Jack, sitting on the bed, like, not talking to one another. That is both sad and funny at the same time. Mm-hmm. But then very, very quickly, you're back into the whole drug dealers plot again. And so, it's a distraction that stops the audience from thinking too much about the logic of this situation because... as with many comedies, if you do think about the logic too much, everything falls apart.
Yeah. But not just that it falls apart, where you're like, come on, guys. Because you can be like, well, you know, they would, you know, in some movies, you're like, well, they would probably be sued if they crashed into that many fences or whatever it might be. But here you're like, guys, we're encouraging and holding up child endangerment.
And the whole business with them calling the cops and, you know, sort of having the criminals trussed up ready for the play. It's absurd.
And also the way the cops are just like, oh, you set this up. Yeah, well, shall in no way infer that possibly you were part of a rival gang or have done anything else wrong. It's just like, thanks, guys. And then you get the key to the city.
Yeah. But again, comedy, you know.
Okay, so the baby arrives.
Sorry, I know I've completely... I'm ruining the format of the show.
No, you're not. No, we format this is how a very we do loose it too. Term.
We are also sometimes heavy on the com.
Yeah, these are all really good points. So the baby arrives. Yes, immediately starts crying. They're like, what do we feed it? And Tom Selleck says, I don't know. You were a baby once. What did you eat?
And he also says... something soft.
But also as if implying that Tom Selleck was never a baby.
Yeah, Tom Selleck was born a 35-year-old man with a mustache.
With that mustache.
Yeah. So he runs to the store to buy some baby food, and, you know, he asks one of the clerks there, say, you know, baby food. They point to an aisle. He walks down the aisle, and it is just this towering aisle of diapers and food, and his reaction is just so appropriate, because it's like, are you kidding me?
How do I know what
how many types of baby food are there?
Yeah.
I must say, this scene is one of the ones that I feel doesn't hold up quite as well, just because he's so obstinately aggressive to the woman who is genuinely trying to help him.
Yeah.
And telling him the truth, you know, giving him real useful information. And for the sake of the comedy, he is just... obstinately ignorant and willfully aggressive towards her with his responses.
Well, I read that as A, he's stressed out, but I think primarily because he's aggressive because he realizes, I think, that if he in any way seems confused, it's gonna come out that they have this mystery baby, and that's and that's why he's like, no, I totally know. Wait, how do I know what they're allergic to? How old is a baby? And it's...
And I understand that, but, you know, she doesn't know him. You know, they're not, she doesn't know who he is. So it's not like gossip's going to get around about him or something. It's just, it felt it felt pitched a little weird. I'm sure at the time I found it absolutely hilarious, but watching it now, I just felt so much empathy for the poor assistant.
Do we think that they were maybe on coke when the baby arrived, and that's why everything is a little, like, turned up to 11?
A little manic. I will say, the one thing I really did appreciate about the scene is, like, the idea of, well, yeah, you could, like, that one's the bestseller. It's like, great. She goes, because it's the cheapest. Okay. Well, this one, well, unless the baby has an iron, you know, and so the idea of, like, I don't know what to buy.
The flowchart that you have to negotiate.
Yeah. And that is, that I found very relatable with it.
Well observed, yeah.
With a 10-week-old. But yes, I agree. He comes off very, very brash. But there is that funny line of, well, how old is your baby? And he just holds up his hands and gives, like, a general size.
About that old. Which, again, not entirely inappropriate, actually. I mean,
yeah. Oh, God, well, no. Because, like, for non-parents, it's like, with a lot of babies, it, up to very many ages, you can be like, well, it's, you know, it's not walking, so it's probably right under this age.
Yeah.
And then, but even there, you have, like, a span of a year or more. And yeah, then after that, you're like, this is baby is walking. Is it taller than a table? It's, you know, like, yeah. It's very hard to gauge.
Well, and it's funny, too, when he shows up at the store, he starts to grab the baby food because it's a baby food. You know, he said, was this good for babies? She says, well, that's for toddlers. He goes, what's a toddler? But there is that, like,
to be fair, what is a toddler? That's kind of, you know,
that
that's
complete
one of those
ineptitude of, like, I don't know what we have at home.
Yeah, if you have no experience with babies, that is entirely realistic. Like, what is the difference between an infant and a toddler? I don't even know.
Yeah, and so yeah, so then we get a series of misadventures of Tom Selleck and Steve Guttenberg trying to raise this baby, change diapers, and he bought, like, the super absorbent giant diapers. Of course, the baby pees as soon as the diaper falls off. That's classic. So we get a series of misadventures, and one of the things I loved, I mean, there's, like, the whole, like, how do we make a bottle? How do we, you know, rock the baby to sleep? All these, you know, kind of funny, goofy, inept dads.
Talcum powder everywhere. Yeah. Yeah.
There's a scene of them, like, washing the dishes, or, you know, and, like, the whole sink is, like, full and overflowing and everything is wet. And that is one of the things that, like, nobody told me about being a parent is, like, literally for that first, like, 2 months, everything is wet because you're always washing bottles. So the kitchen is just always wet. Nothing dries. Your clothes are wet because baby's spitting. Like, everything is wet all the time. And I'm like, that is one of the weird things about this movie that I was like, that is
accurate.
Very relatable and accurate. And it's, like, not even a joke, really. It's just, like,
yeah, no, it's not that part of it isn't really played for laughs, is it?
Right.
But I think that, again, as we said before, it speaks to the fact that, you know, a lot of the people involved in making this movie were parents and clearly put those things into, because they're relatable, because they're universal, because every parent recognizes, as you say, those moments and those situations.
And I feel also like it's sort of written and directed and choreographed in a way that is also very interesting, because you could see it being, like, played, you know, almost like a cartoon, just like diapers flying everywhere. Yeah. And you know, like, and it's not that. And it's also, like, it's those, like, comedic bits and montages, they're actually done kind of slowly. They're actually discussing, how do you do these things? Like, it's not quite like an instruction manual for the actual new parent watching, but almost, you know what I mean? Like, it is very, like, I don't know if naturalistic is the word here, but, like, it's kind of, it's very, like, a sort of slow, quiet, funny.
Right. Yeah, I mean, they're not subtle, but as you say, but it's not a cartoon either. And they do that comedy thing where they make a joke out of something one time to get all the humor out of it. And then the next time they have to do it, like change the diapers or something, then they're fine. By that time, they've learned that's no longer funny. So they've learned how to do it now. Now we'll find something else that's funny, like, yeah, making formula or something.
Yeah. And so we get this, like, series of, like, comic misadventures. The landlady, Mrs. Hannigan, is that who it is?
Hathaway.
Oh, no, Miss Hathaway. Miss Hannigan is Annie. Miss Hathaway shows up and she's like, oh, by the way, there was this package for you downstairs. and oh, what a cute baby. Or she says, oh, it's a baby. And Tom Selleck says, why is that what everyone says the first time they see yeah. it? Oh, it's a baby. They have this package floating around the house. Then some drug dealers show up at the house and they're like, oh, we're here for the package. And I mean, they're very clearly not there for the baby. And it's the
boss detective guy from CSI.
I was going to say Paul Guilfoyle. Yeah, well, I'd yeah. completely forgotten he was in this. And when I saw it, I was like, wait a minute.
And it's because like I can only in my mind see him as this like sort of jovial but very professional police type person.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And here he's like, I'm a bad guy.
Yeah, and it's all very, you know, it's very broad. You know, this is very like broad New York drug dealers kind of, you know. So they're like, oh, you're here for the package. Well, okay, here's the baby. Thanks. Bye.
And there's yeah. this, again, tiny funny exchange about powdered milk. Yeah. He's like, all right, oh, wait, I'll take your
powdered milk. And they're like, oh, yeah, the powdered milk.
Big wink, yeah.
And again, you have that weird leap thing where they're just kind of like, okay. Like, is this yeah. part of like a plan that we hadn't heard about? And there's this very kind of cute exchange down on the street where they're like, how do you put a baby in a car? Anyway, because yeah. they have this little like very fancy sportsy car and they're like, do we put it in the trunk? We can't put it. I think we're supposed to have a baby seat. And it's just like kind of mirroring what's been going on upstairs. Right.
And so, yeah, they hand the baby off and then Tom Selleck comes back in. He's, you know, they're like, oh man, I kind of miss her already. And then he sees the package and he goes, wait, what's this? He goes, it's a package. He's like, oh no, this was the package. So runs downstairs as to chase after them so that to stop them from driving away with Mary. Trips, package bursts open. It's little baggies of heroin. He's like, oh my goodness. Goes outside, tries to take the baby back from the drug dealers and hand them the actual package. But the mounted police officer intervenes.
Which I love because it means that they bring a horse into the lobby.
Yep.
You know what just hit me? Do you think that it's heroin so that we never have the implication of like if it's cocaine, do they keep it? Do they not keep it? Do they like...
Maybe. Oh, possibly. Possibly, yeah. Yeah.
Like not explicitly, but it just hit because I was like, because heroin it seems like... 80s. Heroin seems kind of brutal, but if it was cocaine, then you would have like... You know, they would have to have a whole subplot about like, yeah, well,
Ted Danson's an actor in the 80s.
Yeah,
yeah,
you
know. Yeah, exactly.
But also, isn't horse another name for heroin? Well,
it is.
Oh,
so yes, there's a horse yeah. looking for horse. Yeah. And, I don't know.
Isn't anyway. This also when the undercover, or not yes. undercover, I should say, plain clothes cop turns up as well? Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, Tom Selleck gets the baby back, goes upstairs.
And still has the heroin.
Yeah, still has the heroin. They hide it in the baby diaper. And there's the DEA agent or the drug enforcement task person.
I think he's just a vice squad, you know, narcotics yeah, officer, yeah.
Shows up as well. And, you know, there's something suspicious going on here.
There are some wonderful character moments in there. There are sort of comedy character moments in there. But when they're doing the farce bit of trying to get him out of the apartment.
Yes.
And double speak as well when they're talking about, one of them's talking about one thing, the other's talking about the other, trying to, all the implications and sort of double entendres and stuff going on with the policeman. It's very... that feels like the most sort of traditionally comedic part of the yeah. movie. You know, it feels like,
it's the Frenchest part.
Yeah, it's like,
it is.
That's true. Yeah, I've seen this before. I know how this scene works, but they pull it off really well. It's very well executed.
Yeah. Yeah. So now suddenly we're in the middle. Like this to me, I was like, oh, this movie just took a very different turn. Like the introduction of heroin into this movie caught me so off guard. And like roaming drug dealers, landlady Miss Hathaway shows up as they're both trying to go to work, and she's like, oh, I'll babysit. So she babysits. When they get home, she's been tied up. The apartment's been ransacked by the drug dealers, and they're like, and they leave a note saying, next time we take the baby. There's also I can't remember if this is that night, but there's a funny moment of Ted Danson reading a boxing play-by-play to the baby. Yes. Tom Selleck.
Yeah. And I love how he's like, it doesn't matter what you're reading. It doesn't matter what you say. It's the tone. It's
how you say it.
Which is so true.
It is.
That is a lovely moment, that, as well, because I mean, it shows the character development, obviously. Yes. But it also shows the kind of a certain amount of ingenuity on the part of the character, going like, oh, okay, I've realized, you know, I've got over myself.
Yeah.
And sort of got past the whole frustration and the ego to realize, oh, okay, actually I can do this if I just learn how to do it, rather than insisting I should already know.
I can do this in a way where I also can get the things I like.
Yes.
Like I can read my sports magazines. But yeah, so middle of the night, Ted Danson, this is about halfway through the movie, Ted Danson comes home, stumbles over the ransacked apartment.
Gets attacked.
Yeah, gets attacked.
In a very funny scene.
Yeah, and they're like, okay, here's your baby, you deal with it. And we get like a little mini montage of Ted Danson trying to do everything that they did already. And they're like, should we help him? It's like, nah, let him suffer for a few more hours.
Which is also because, you know, they now know that the baby is not the package. So they know that, like, Jack didn't intentionally saddle them with... Right. A surprise baby.
The baby is, and to go back to the leap point, this is when they realize the baby is just a coincidence. The package was the heroin.
So punishing him, like, yes, he wasn't there to do the stuff, but he didn't know there was a baby coming. He didn't saddle them with the baby. I get, though, and it's funny because they're like, hey, this is your baby, deal with it, which I know a lot of people who are both of the parents of the baby will say to each other.
Oh, yeah. It's like, your turn. While they go off and sleep blissfully. That's the other part that's very, very realistic. Oh, finally, someone else is taking care of it. I can catch some sleep. You know, this is what grandparents are for in real life.
Ted Danson's mom ends up coming over and he's like, oh, she looks just like you. Please, do you want to take her? And she goes, I'm going to do something for you. I'm going to do nothing.
Again, a woman who's like, nope.
Yep. So you get Tom Selleck asking his girlfriend to take care of the baby because she's a woman. Ted Danson asking his mom to take care of the baby because she's a woman. And they're both like, you guys got it. We have a little bit of the three men taking care of this little baby. And then they get a news clipping. We get a news clipping that the director has been attacked by the drug dealers. And there's like... a warning in there, and they are like, okay, here's what we're going to do. We are going to lose our plainclothes tail, because the plainclothes officers are just always hanging out in the lobby. So they Ted Danson disguises himself as a pregnant woman, hiding the baby under his dress, effectively under his coat,
as if stealing a watermelon.
Right. Tom Selleck and Steve Guttenberg go another direction. They switch cars. They get in Ted Danson's cab. They go to a construction site where I assume it's the same construction site that that Tom Selleck is working on.
So they know
the place. They set up the drug dealers. They're trying to record them. But then Steve Guttenberg
falls over for no reason.
Falls over inside the little thing that he's hiding in. The drug dealers, a very slow elevator chase ensues.
The slowest chase in the history of cinema.
Which I think is amazing, though.
Which is funny, yeah.
It is, you know, you have the heist element of both of them, like, this very strategically placed pile of pipes that falls on them, but also the, like, turning on and off the right switch for whatever elevator, which is so stupid and really funny. And yes, it's so slow, and, like, they pass each other and get threatened, and then they stop, and it's just yeah.
Shouting insults at one another. I'm going to hit you.
through the grates. They get down to the bottom. The cops showed up because they've already tipped off the cops and the vice guy who was kind of suspicious of them. They hand over the video.
Wants to hold the baby again.
Yeah, they hand over the video and they're like, here are the drug dealers. We saved the day. And the guy's like, can I hold the baby? And they're like, no. And it's just like really abrupt, like aggressive end to that scene. And I was like, okay. And that's the end of the movie. But no, there's more.
No, of course not. Yeah.
There's like a whole like 25, 30 minute epilogue where Sylvia shows up. She's an actress who, again, as we mentioned, dropped off the baby because she couldn't take care of it. She felt overwhelmed. And she's like, I'm going to take the baby back to London, where I have a network of folks who will help me.
And I want to be very clear. I don't think she's an unfit mother because she got overwhelmed or possibly had, you know, postpartum depression or a psychosis. She was an unfit mother because she abandoned a baby in a hallway.
It was a foyer.
It was a foyer that also the foyer of the penthouse, meaning that if all three men were out of town, nobody was going to see that baby for an unspecified amount of time.
Yeah.
And that elevator is not like keyed. It's clearly anybody can catch that elevator to get to the top.
Yeah, the landlord, people just show up at their front door.
Yeah. It is good that she's got a support network in place, I suppose. That's the one thing, is that, you know, she's now established, okay, I have a support network in England that I can, that can help me raise this child, rather than just saying, I'm going to take the kid and go to England where I'll be alone and nobody can help me.
And Anthony,
but
do you
have socialized healthcare.
Do you have any thoughts on her accent?
Oh, it's so bad. I'm sorry. I'm not Anthony, but...
It's quite bad, yes. You know.
I mean, she probably did show up for like a week of shooting. She's like,
is it obviously bad even to Americans?
It's obviously bad.
It's obviously bad to a Swede.
Yeah. Your two languages removed at that point.
At certain points, I could maybe buy it as like, you know, she's an actress, but she's worked a ton in the US, except that they met in the UK. But it's just, it's so, and it feels like a very like 80s style accent where it was like, we don't care.
Oh, no, believe me, there are still accents.
Oh, no,
like
I know, but just like something about it feels very like, we just need to make sure that everyone understands that she's Sylvia. After that, we don't care.
Yeah, geographically nondescript, too. It's like English.
Yeah, well, to be fair, most actors in England do learn as part of their training an accent of English, which is not real, called received pronunciation.
Yes.
Which is not actually, you know, a regional accent of any kind. It's just vaguely posh English.
Yeah.
That's not what she's doing. She's doing PP, perceived pronunciation.
Very good. Oh, my gosh. She's doing a PP. I'm going to laugh at that for 20 minutes. So she takes the baby. They, you know, they give her all this stuff and they're moping around. So they decide like, let's go to the airport. Let's stop her. Let's be her support network. So they run to the airport. They get there. They go through security check remarkably fast.
This is also the security.
This is also like pre-9/11.
Wow,
you know, like
yeah,
it's so weird. It's just so weird to watch.
Yeah, no, you can run through and they could have like Die Hard style smoked while walking through the airport as well.
Yeah, and they just, you know, aren't immediately tackled, don't stand in line for an hour, and the whole thing is just watching it now, you're like, oh my goodness. It's like, is it Bullet that ends in the airport as well? I remember watching that for the first time in a while a few years ago, and I'd forgotten about the ending sequence at the airport, and yeah, watching it from a modern perspective, you're just like, oh wow, oh, it was so insecure, how did we ever think that was safe?
Yeah, and also like three rushing men with desperation in their eyes. It's just like, at best, they're trying to hunt down a woman who didn't want to talk to them, you know?
Yeah. Well, she didn't want to talk because she was a baby. She couldn't talk. But I will tell you very briefly my funniest TSA story. My wife and I were behind these two people in Canadian tuxedos. For the listener, if you're not familiar with a Canadian tuxedo, it is denim jeans.
On denim.
And a denim jacket. Husband and wife, probably in their like late 40s, early 50s, and they were going through the metal detector. The metal detector went off and they're like, do you have anything in your pockets? And the husband was like, oh, yes, I do. And he pulled out from one pocket an entire handful of loose screws and he put it in the bin. And then he pulled out from the other pocket an entire handful of loose screws and put it in the bin and sent it. And then he walked through. And then his wife goes through and the metal detector goes off. They're like, ma'am, do you have anything in your pocket? She goes, yes, I do. She reaches into one pocket, pulls out an entire handful of loose screws. And then in the other pocket, another four handfuls of loose screws. In-
you know what I hope that was? That they had, for the past 20 years of being married, done a whole bit about fancy a screw.
Amazing. But I was just like, what is happening?
And how would you possibly... like, as if they'd forgotten like that they had them ago. In their pockets. Like, walking through a mountain, oh yeah, I forgot. I've got all these loose screws in my pocket.
I mean, I've like helped build sets and stuff. And if you put a screw in your pocket, one screw, you're going to stab yourself.
True.
Oh, anyway.
That's
anyway.
Amazing.
Oh, man. So they get to the airport just in time for the plane to depart. They mope back to their apartment. She's sitting in the foyer with the baby.
I love
She's...
the taxi driver on the way to the airport, though.
Oh, yeah.
Where they're talking, like, he's giving them some tips about parenthood.
Oh, and I love when he's like, oh, and when she says, when your kid says daddy for the first time, it melts your heart. And they're like, go faster.
Could you drive a little faster, please?
So, yeah, they get back home. She's there. She's like, I couldn't go. I want to be an actor in New York. I just can't figure out a way to make it work. And they're like, you can move in. And everyone's like on the edge of tears. You can move in with us. Yeah, we'll make a room for you and for Mary. Well, and
there is that wonderful line where she says, do you have room? And he's like, Peter goes, I'll build you room. That's just a really good line.
Yeah. They're all just so excited. And then, the four of them live happily ever after with this little baby.
And this bizarre four-person wide pram that they...
Yeah.
That handle is so strange. It's great physical comedy. You'll notice it wouldn't fit in the elevator.
They never show it going in the elevator. Yeah.
It's so goofy. They all look at each other and, like, on cue. It's, like, very... It's, like, the goofiest part of this movie because it's very, like, and here's the end. Whoomp, we opened up the handles. And then they all do that, like, kind of
little swing
music
setup,
video
yeah.
thing where they, like, step up and then they go forward. They, like, do, like, the wind-up and then the push of
but
the
you
car
can get away with that at the end. You've had you've oh, yeah. got your happy ending. It. You know, it's like we're into the credits. The happy ending's here. You can be a little bit goofy. Everybody's having a good cry at the end.
Yeah, and it is very like slow motion freeze frame laugh. And I feel like I'll allow it.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Okay. So we can simplify some of these points we go over. How do we feel about the main three and or baby?
How do you mean feel about them?
Do you like them? Do you not like them? Thoughts? Because my thing is, I wish that, because you get hints of things, like, I want to know more about Steve Guttenberg's sad sack, and I want a little bit more, like, I don't mean like, oh, they're poorly fleshed out. I think it's the opposite. They are fleshed out just enough that I'm like, okay, but you started. Do more. Because I could have almost accepted this movie if they'd been kind of flat, because that would have also worked just like for the structure. But I want more of that, and not to help me understand them or care about them as potential fathers for this baby, all that stuff. I just want to know more. Like, because I like them. I think they play very well, these like different stereotypes of a certain type of 80s man, modern man, whatever you want to call it, and then they're very quickly, you know, modulated or softened by baby.
Well, and I think that's one of the reasons why the movie works. Yes, you could have made this movie with them being a bit flatter, but then it wouldn't have been the highest grossing movie of 1987. That's what makes it so good, is that they get that balance just right. There is enough that they all, I mean, yes, they're caricatures, but they all feel just real enough without being laborious and without giving you so much detail that you lose the speed, because any more, it feels like any more detail on these characters and it would slow the movie down too much. But if there wasn't as much as there is, as you say, each of the characters would be a little bit flatter, and therefore I don't think you'd be as emotionally invested in them. I think it strikes that balance really, really well.
And I really like that, not just the open relationship thing, but you have this revolving door, and I kind of like that there's never any of the classic hint of like them trying to trick women or trying to fob them off or promising them relationships. It feels like everyone involved, all of these women, are just like, you know, cheerful, consenting, open participants.
It's all consensual. There's no judgment. There's no, you know, negative vibes.
Yeah. And yeah. I really, really like that, both in general and for a movie from 1987.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. That's good. I'm sure that was probably not many movies made around that time that had that attitude towards promiscuous men.
Possibly another French aspect of the movie. Do you have a favorite part, AJ?
I mean, just as a new parent, just like the whole like struggling to figure out how to take care of this baby stuff tickled me in a way. It probably wouldn't have felt as funny if I didn't have a baby. Do you know what I mean? But it felt very, Anthony, you pointed out observational humor. Like it just felt very honest and very funny and very relatable in a way that's where my mind space is right now. So I enjoyed it.
I would say one of my favorite moments, not necessarily my top favorite moment, but one of my favorite moments, actually, we haven't mentioned yet, which is the infamous goodnight sweetheart sing-along thing to soothe the baby to sleep, which in itself is lovely and cute. But what really makes that scene is what happens immediately afterwards when Tom Selleck's character gets into bed with his girlfriend and she's like, I can't sleep. Could you sing to me? And the pillow fight that ensues, that's just a lovely.
And then he does a tiny little, like, four bars of boom, 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 boom.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's. Yeah, that is, again, like, that is one of those things that makes him feel like a real person.
Exactly, exactly.
Because you have those, like, again, stupid bits with screws with your partner. Like, you know, like, the tiny stupid things that makes it clear that you click.
Well, you could absolutely see those people in that relationship. You could just see her saying that. There's nothing forced or contrived about it at all. It's absolutely the reaction that a real person would have in that situation. Mm-hmm. And for that reason alone, I think it's a really, really good, funny part of the movie.
Well, and even just the honesty of, like, as they're all singing this three-part harmony, which is, I can't believe I neglected to mention that. It's so cute. But as, like, she's falling asleep, they're just getting, like, quieter and quieter. And it's just kind of fading away.
Creeping, like, back. Yeah. Backing away, creeping back, like, out the room. Yeah.
That's what you do when you're like, okay, I think I can stop rocking the bassinet. Just
but you can't quite stop singing because she'll figure out that you stopped singing.
And then I'm just going to kind of, like, watch for a minute. Okay. You know? The whole scene is wonderful.
Yeah, I really like the getting into bed thing. I also, just that the very end of the heist of them being, again, stuck in those elevators, it's so bizarre. And then Ted Danson, like, trying to calm the baby down while he is still dressed in his weird lady getup. It's just a very bizarre situation. It's really funny.
One thing that I want to mention, actually, because AJ, you said quite rightly that Ted Danson is barely in this movie. Really, you know, he's only in it for a total screen time of maybe 40, 45 minutes.
Yeah.
And yet, he feels like, you know, he's earned his place as one of the three title characters. Until you stop to think about it, you don't really think about the fact that he hasn't been in the movie until,
because they talk about him all the time.
Well, there's that. It's true. But I think also
he's sort of present.
But I think it's also just a testament to how good Ted Danson is.
Yeah.
Because
he's great.
In those opening 5 minutes, and then from the moment that he returns back to the apartment, he is just, he's fantastic on screen. He plays the part so well, mixes the comedy with the character and all that sort of thing, and even has the sad moments when Sylvia returns and they're doing that whole sitting on the bed thing. I think I was a fan of Cheers, but that was literally all I'd ever seen Ted Danson in. And that's probably true of most people when they went to see this movie, I think. But this movie sold me on him. It's one of the things that made me a fan of his for many, many years since, because he's so good in it with so little to work with.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he feels like you get some of the sort of, like, cocky womanizer, but he also feels, again, very human, very real.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and he has those moments where he realizes, oh, I'm an asshole.
Yeah.
All right, so on Rotten Tomatoes, this has, and this fascinates me immensely, this has a 76% fresh rating from critics and a 47% fresh rating from audiences.
That is criminal.
And 6.1 on IMDb. And I wonder if this might be, because critics wouldn't, like, on a larger scale, re-review this. So the reviews number is picked primarily from contemporary reviews. Whereas I could see people, I mean, obviously, Rotten Tomatoes is younger than this film. So, like, maybe the people who have been grading it now have been watching it with the later eyes.
I mean, without meaning to sound too dismissive, user reviews, user score ratings on the internet are useless for anything. Because nobody can even agree on what 3 stars out of 5 means. So, like, reviews, actual written reviews, sure, even from users, those can be, you know, useful, informative, instructive. Star ratings, absolute codswallop. Don't pay any attention to those.
Absolutely. My favorite thing is when you realize that this is an old person who doesn't realize that, like, the stars are from bad to good. They're just like, one star, this was great. And you're just like, aw, Bertha. What would you give this out of 10 clean diapers?
I think I would probably give it 8 out of 10. It's not quite 10 out of 10 just because there are some elements of it which have not held up and aren't quite timeless. And the whole drugs, the what amazes me about this movie is how quickly they resolve the issue with the drug dealers. It's like 3 scenes and it's done. Wow. Yeah. You know, it's like set up the conflict, complicate the conflict, solve the conflict. That's it. That's the entire sequence.
There aren't a lot of movies where heroin is just like the distraction while the magician does his actual thing.
Yeah. Right.
It's the MacGuffin. So yeah, I give it 8 out of 10. I realize that I like this movie a lot more than many people. Both at the time and in retrospect. And part of that is just down to the fact that I enjoyed it so much when I first saw it, when I was, like I say, I was still a teenager, so naturally it's going to stay with me through the years. But watching it, like I say, for the first time in maybe 10 plus years in preparation for this podcast, I was like, no, actually, this is genuinely a really funny movie. Not perfect, no, but very, very good. And again, Leonard Nimoy,
yeah,
directed this. What?
Yeah. I mean, on this show, we both accept and strongly believe in the beautifying filter of nostalgia. We're all for it.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
I think I would give this a 7 because, like, again, like you're saying, on the whole, it has a lot of good things. Like, I didn't come out of it feeling cringy or uncomfortable. It was silly. I laughed. It had some nice bits. I don't have, like, huge issues with it.
Yeah.
What about you, AJ?
Yeah, I'd probably give it an 8. It's so, again, as somebody who, like, I wrote my dissertation about comedy, I feel like I can see jokes coming a mile away. In particular, it's like jokes about babies have been done a million times. There was just something about this movie, and it's probably my current situation, but there was something about this movie that just tickled my funny bone and, like, made me laugh out loud a handful of times, which is just so rare for a comedy to do. So, yeah, I'd say, like, an 8. It was very funny. The 3 guys are charming. The baby's adorable.
I think that's worth emphasizing as well, is that it's not just that it's a funny movie. It's that those 3 leads, you know, in the same way that it's impossible to imagine Indiana Jones with Tom Selleck in the role now. You know, yeah. Remember he famously was, you know, going to be Indiana Jones. And now you can't imagine it with anybody other than Harrison Ford. I cannot imagine this movie with anybody other than these 3 because they're so good and they inhabit those characters so well. And they do genuinely have charm and charisma, you know, and good delivery.
Mm-hmm. And Leonard Nimoy apparently saw several hundred pairs of twins to cast this.
Oh, I can believe that. Yeah.
Yeah, because they had to be super cute. And I read, this is amazing trivia, that towards the end of filming, the 2 babies that played the baby, they had lost interest in the 3 main actors and started, because, like, they were comfortable, so they were more interested in the boom mic. And would just, like, wouldn't, and then, like, their eye lines would just be off because they were like, ooh, fluffy, you know. So they had to figure out all these different ways to, like, hide the mic so that they could get the sound, but the baby would care about its daddies.
Have a fake boom mic and stick that behind the actor's head.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay, so, you know, we've hinted at some of the at there being flaws, but can we fix this movie? What would make it better for you, Anthony?
Oh, that's a really hard one to say just because, as I say, you know, this movie is kind of hardwired into me now. I mean, you could improve it by maybe updating the sexual politics, which are, despite what we said about how progressive some aspects of it are, nevertheless, there are moments where it's not so progressive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there is some dismissal of women and, you know, certainly denigration of women and, shall we say, non-heteronormative lifestyles. You know, there's aspects like that that you could update for. But I think this is one of those movies that is so, because you have the whole ridiculous heroin subplot, it is so of its time that if you start tinkering with it too much, you would actually spoil the movie. You know,
well, maybe we'll have to have you back on for the weird Zac Efron remake.
Yes. Oh, I'm not sure whether I could bring myself to watch that. I don't know.
So I have two things. One is tiny, and because there are three non-white characters with lines in this movie, and none of them get more than like four lines.
That is another aspect, yeah.
And this is A, just a criticism in general, but again, B, in New York.
Yeah.
And I think you have like maybe one more character of color who's an amazing roller skater in the park, you know? So the three that you have is taxi driver, store clerk, and bad guy henchman. So just like they could have a black friend, a Hispanic friend, they could, you know. But my thing to make this better is I think it would be funnier and screwed up a tiny bit if they didn't know whose baby it was. Like, it's a note that isn't addressed.
Like, this is your baby.
Oh, right.
Exactly.
Right.
Like, it isn't addressed by name, and then it's signed by a lady name, you know, that they all acknowledge that they've slept with Sheila, Lucy, Anne-Marie. Possibly they have slept with multiple Anne-Maries in the last couple of years. So they're, like, trying to figure it out, and they're trying to find all these women, but kind of, like, in the store, not make it too obvious what's going on. Mm-hmm. I don't know why that's just funny
that
in my head.
Fun.
Because you also get a little bit of like the Mamma Mia thing. Like they all bond with the baby. So at the end, they're like, well, it doesn't even matter. I mean, obviously the mom, if the mom shows up, she would know. Or she didn't because she actually did sleep with all three of them.
No.
Then when Sylvia shows up, then that's when Ted Danson is like, oh, Sylvia. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or worse, yeah, if she has slept with all three of them, and so you still don't know.
But even when, you know, she shows up and two of them are a little sad, and then they realize, you know, it doesn't matter because family is what you make it.
I like that. That's fun.
Okay.
I mean, again, it would be a different movie, but yeah, it would be interesting to see.
It would. But you would also then get rid of the, like, Jack is an asshole, because, like, what did he do? Anyway. All right, we made it a little better. We tried. Can we make it weird? Because my weird is, first I was like, is it also just nobody's baby in the weird? But I want there to be, and this is again like the French farce thing. I want to turn that up. I kind of want there to be like three or four different quote unquote packages in rotation so that you get even more of the cross speaking. Like everyone thinks that they're giving away or picking up their thing, but it's not. Like the heroin guys show up and they pick up accidentally a script that has been left there, and the script person accidentally takes Peter's blueprints, you know, like, so everyone is trying to come back and get the thing that is super important for them at that moment.
So you have like four floating MacGuffins just roaming through this movie.
And everyone just keeps talking at odds with each other, because that would also make the heroin aspect funnier is not something I ever thought I would say, because then you have like everyone keeps exchanging the packages. So nobody can say where anything is anyway, except the baby. The baby gets to stay in one place because I think that feels safer to me.
Yeah. But I mean, kind of then it becomes three men and a kilo of heroin, really, doesn't it? Rather than the baby. That's the problem.
Which is possibly a movie I would watch. Are they all dressed as nuns also? Like that?
I'm pretty sure I've seen that one.
AJ, how would you make this weird?
So I had a few different ideas. Like, first of all, as I mentioned, like the introduction of the drug subplot, I was not prepared for Steven Soderbergh's Traffic, the movie, with a baby in it. Like, I was like, oh God, okay, this is so dark. It's just like took a very dark turn. And like, the whole, they've ransacked the apartment, tied up the landlady, and it's scary. Like, there's like, it's legitimately scary in that, like, even when.
And the next time we take the baby?
Yeah. And when they hand off the baby to the drug dealers, Jenna loves this movie. So Jenna was watching it. She goes, I know what's going to happen, but I'm just so nervous. Like, aww. And so there is that like quality to it. And so I was like, do you just go full hardcore into like Traffic and, or, you know, or Crash or, Requiem for a Dream and just get like really, really dark with this movie? And I was like, that wouldn't be as fun. the one thing I kind of landed on making it weird was, what if we're in like the world of Roger Rabbit and the cartoon character that Steve Guttenberg has created lives in the apartment with them?
I love
so
it.
So you just get like it. Three men, a baby, and a cartoon cat. And it's like...
And that is just, so something that they would do in the 80s.
Yeah.
And then the diaper changing scenes are just total farce.
Yeah. Then you just go full cartoon.
And then the heroine is just like chalk, which is something that the cartoons sniff. So you have like cartoon villains trying to chase down their chalk.
Yeah. Cause then you could like, the drug dealers could be these like, kind of like the weasels in Roger Rabbit could yes. be these like big cartoonish henchmen. And yeah, you could just get into some really wacky misadventures if half the other characters were cartoon characters.
That is amazing. do you want to top that?
I wouldn't, and I don't think I can top that. I would never have even thought of that, let alone something more weird.
What's your weirdness?
I honestly don't know. I'm afraid I'm woefully unprepared for this section of the show because
you're just loving everything and don't want to change. That's acceptable.
Pretty much, yeah. I can't, like I say, I've seen this movie, you know, enough times and have enough fondness for it that I can't imagine doing anything to it that wouldn't just be a completely different movie.
That is a perfectly acceptable answer. We do that sometimes too. Did we learn anything from this movie?
Do you know, I think we did in a sense, and it may not be massively profound. It's the sort of thing that, again, from a modern perspective, you're just like, well, duh. But in the 80s, the idea that men could look after a child without a woman present, and it wouldn't immediately be a terrible disaster that, you know, that everybody should frown upon.
And they can bond with the baby.
Right, yeah. Was actually kind of progressive. You know, I think that was
a very good point
to send out to people at that time. As I say, you think about it now, it seems absurd that you would need to tell people that. But in the 80s, yeah.
Not absurd because you still have a lot of like, oh, I'm going to babysit the kids or I don't know what they eat. In 2021 as well, sadly. Did you learn anything? I learned that the real family is the baby inside us all along. AJ, what did you learn?
I mean, I would kind of echo Anthony on this. I think that you made a really good point about like the time this movie was made, but also I just think that it's also preparing for fatherhood. I can't tell you how many books I got that were like, well, you're going to have to start doing laundry. You're going to have to learn how to do dishes. You know, this kind of like really, and the fact that we're still getting like that attitude towards men caring for a child in 2020 is kind of bonkers to me.
The other, if there's one other thing we learned, it's that nobody, not even somebody as tall and handsome and thin as Ted Danson, can make those baggy silken chinos look good.
That is true. Yes, we did learn that as well.
That is the most important lesson one we can all take with us. Next week we will be talking about My Best Friend's Wedding. Anthony, ooh, do you want to plug anything to our audiences?
Well, I'll say if they haven't watched My Best Friend's Wedding yet, they should. That's quite a good movie. if you want to hear me ramble on about things that are absolutely very, very much not rom-coms, you can find me on lots of other podcasts. I do a heavy metal podcast called Thrash It Out. I do a podcast where I talk to other authors called Writing and Breathing. You can hear me elsewhere here around on the Incomparable Network. And you can find out more about me at my website, anthonyjohnston.com, and I'll spell it for you. It's AntonyJohnston.com, and that's got links and information to everything.
It will, of course, be linked in our show notes, and you can be found on Twitter as well, right?
Yes.
Do you prefer that people not find you there?
No, Twitter's the same. Again, it's just my name. You just have to spell it right, which, you know, most people don't.
You can find our show notes with all those links at theincomparable.com/chickflickfix. You can support us by becoming a member at The Incomparable, or if you want to give us Patreon money, or just, you know, give us those absolutely useless stars on Apple Podcasts, feel free to do so. We're chickflickfix on Twitter and Instagram. We'll be back next week. Say goodbye, AJ.
Goodbye, AJ.
Say goodbye, Anthony.
Bye, everyone.